Good morning. The court calls United States versus DeKalb. Since this is a certified case, the government will go first. And as you can see, Senior Judge Cox will be joining us on this case, as he will on the other cases this week. Thank you very much.
Chief Judge Baker, honorable members of this court, I'm Captain Tyson Kynes, Colonel Don Christensen, and together we represent the United States this morning. The first step this court should take...
A little louder,
yes.
There's something going on with the mic.
The first step this court should take before evaluating defense counsel's performance...
Sorry, one second. Can you hear in the back okay? All right. Please.
Yes, Your Honor. The first step this court should take before evaluating defense counsel's performance through the strong presumption that they provided effective representation should be to have an understanding of the strategic objectives the defense was trying to achieve from the outset of trial. The strategy that the defense wanted to achieve was to demonstrate that the injuries to the victim's anus were caused by slight and brief penetration during an otherwise consensual sexual encounter. They developed the strategy early on because their client had made a statement to law enforcement investigators from the beginning, admitting that he was involved in a consensual encounter that involved anal intercourse. This was also consistent with the victim's statement that described the anal intercourse as very brief, just consistent with the appellees. Now, the tactic that the defense counsel employed at trial was to use cross-examination of the government's expert to show that the victim's injuries could have been caused by brief, partial penetration.
Can I ask you one question as an outset? You certified this case on the Harrington v. Richter, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And now, not inappropriately, you're essentially arguing the IAC case.
Yes, Your Honor.
From the government's standpoint. What... understanding that the CCA did not cite to the case, what principle of law or what is it in Harrington v. Richter that you think the CCA did not apply or warrants your certification to this court?
Yes, Your Honor.
You did prevail, did you not, on one level?
We did. On the deficiency prong, they found that the defense counsel was deficient, but we did prevail on the prejudice prong, Your Honor.
But nonetheless, the government felt it was important to certify the Richter issue.
Yes,
what
sir.
Is it in Harrington v. Richter that is misapprehended or warrants our attention, et cetera?
Yes, Your Honor. 2 points, sir. The reason the government felt that it was important to certify the case was because it was a precedential opinion. It was published in the defense count. Or the government felt that relying on Harrington versus Richter, but also Strickland versus Washington, that the court misapplied the standard of law. They got the standard of law correct, but that they misapplied the standard of law to the facts. And the reason that Richter becomes important is because it's the most on-point Supreme Court case that's describing the Strickland standard in the context of whether a defense counsel needs to consult with an expert in preparation of the case. So that's really the...
So Harrington v. Richter doesn't change the law. It's just that you view that it was so on point, correctly or incorrectly, that it is, it's a question.
Yes, sir. That's exactly what it is. We don't believe that it changes the law, Your Honor. However, we do believe that Richter reinforces and definitely expounds on the substantive legal standards that were established in Richter because it provides guidance to the court when you're specifically dealing with the situation of expert assistance.
Okay. They obviously had a plan. We've got a plan here. And they followed their plan. And it blew up in their face. What do they do after it blows up in their face? Is sticking to, you know, Einstein's definition of stupidity, which is keeping doing the same thing when it's already stopped, hasn't worked once, isn't that IAC?
No, Your Honor. And
the court below found it was IAC, right? You won on prejudice.
Yes, sir. So they found that it was deficiency.
Deficient performance. Okay. Well, here you're cross-examining this person, and it basically blows up in your face. Now, why in that IAC?
Well, because the government would respond respectfully, Your Honor, that the plan did not blow up in the defense counsel's face. That going back to those...
They weren't surprised?
They were surprised, Your Honor, and the affidavits are very clear from defense counsel that they did not expect TB to testify exactly the way that she did. But I would draw this court to consider that very initial plan that they had, which their strategic objective was always to elicit testimony from TB that was consistent with their theory, and that was that the injuries could have been caused by brief and partial anal penetration. And that's exactly what they had, although the testimony didn't come out exactly the way they had planned. They still had to determine whether TB's testimony fundamentally altered their strategy of the case. And the government would say that it didn't, Your Honors, because they were able to elicit from TB on cross-examination that it was physically possible that the injuries could have been caused by, quote, first-time anal entry. It's at JA 188. It was medically possible that the injuries could have been caused by a single insertion or even a partial insertion of the appellee's penis.
That theory works fine if the government expert's testimony was favorable. But obviously it was unfavorable, and they were surprised. And what are we supposed to do with their earlier affidavits where they said repeatedly that they just did not have the depth of experience to cross-examine an expert where the testimony would not be favorable?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that they did have the depth of experience. The ADC...
Well, what do we do with those affidavits?
Well, I will point you to the SDC's affidavit.
What changed between the time they wrote the affidavits where they said they did not have the depth of the experience and later on when they cross-examined?
I'm sorry for interrupting, but I think that their pretrial investigation was what had changed. Really in the context of when they had developed the strategy and when they had submitted the request to the convening authority as well as the motion to compel, and they stated that they were not experts in the area of sexual assault, that was an admission.
Well, despite the fact that they weren't experts, the CCA did acknowledge that they were successful in getting TB to admit that SF's anal injury could have been the result of consensual sex, right?
That's consistent with their strategy.
And did anything change in the course of the trial to allay their concern that more time for the government would lead to investigation that would produce additional negative evidence about the accused?
Yes, there were concerns about, there were additional strategy considerations here. The main being that there were two witnesses that the defense counsel had uncovered that the government had not yet interviewed. One of those was an ex-girlfriend of the appellee who, by defense counsel's affidavit, stated that there were significant information that would have been negative to the appellee's case. There was also, and I also explain that a little bit, that particular witness was only discovered by the defense through a government witness who was initially interviewed, the Howells. Airman Howell testified in the defense's case in chief. So this witness was literally just one step away from the government asking one question to figure out who this ex-girlfriend was. There was also the victim's ex-boyfriend that the defense counsel had interviewed, and it was discovered that he was an initial disclosure witness and that she explained the sexual assault to him in the exact same terms that she was testifying to, that actually that she provided a statement to law enforcement and that she testified to at trial. And when you think about this case, when you read the record, it's very clear that the defense counsel's tactic in combating the victim's testimony was to turn this into a credibility contest. They attacked the victim hard on cross-examination. And when they knew that that was going to be their trial tactic going in, they knew that they were going to open the door to prior consistent statements, then coming in to bolster the victim's testimony. So when confronted with a situation where they know that two harmful witnesses still exist out there, they had an interest in not delaying trial and in making sure that they stayed on track. And in doing that, they had to balance, did they get the information from TB that they set out to elicit on cross-examination? And they did so in this case because they were able to show through an adverse witness that the injuries that were caused were consistent with a brief penetration, with slight penetration, but most importantly, that those injuries were consistent with non-consensual sex as well as consensual sex. So really when it comes down to the elements that the members are going to review, yes, ma'am.
No, you can finish your question. I have another one.
When the members are analyzing the elements in this case, the question isn't whether anal intercourse occurred. The question isn't whether there was force. The question was whether it was consensual. And TB's testimony could not answer that question. And if you look at BO's after trial report, she couldn't answer that question either.
A question that was not clear to me from the record, which is originally the defense had requested an expert and they had agreed to withdraw it in exchange for this same expert's agreeing to not testify about other areas, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Do you know or is there anything in the record that tells us what would have happened to that agreement if they had requested the same expert after the testimony?
The record was silent on that, ma'am. But one thing that we would point the court to is that when the defense counsel entered into this agreement with trial counsel to limit TB's testimony only to the anal injuries and not to the vaginal injuries, that was important for the defense's case because, again, at one point in time, there was a...
No, I understand why that was important because of the spillover and the inferences and things of that nature. My question was just, wouldn't that agreement have been voided if they then requested the same expert?
Yes, that was definitely a risk that they faced. And along with, if the defense in July, when they went to trial, had to take another delay in order to get BO to testify on their behalf or even just to consult with BO, they risked that the government would conduct more investigation and potentially find these two witnesses, but they could also risk losing that pretrial agreement, or not pretrial agreement, but the agreement that they had with the trial counsel regarding this other harmful evidence coming in, which would have been bad for the defense's case, considering that they were trying to paint a picture that this was a completely consensual encounter. And if they had this harmful evidence of vaginal trauma that came in as well, this would start to color this situation in a different light, especially when TB had said to the defense counsel in pretrial interviews that the vaginal trauma was some of the worst that she had ever seen.
Counsel, how critical is Richter to your argument since you acknowledge that Richter didn't change Strickland, it's just an interpretation of the Strickland principles. If we didn't have Richter, would you still prevail today?
I believe so, Your Honor. I just think that Richter's helpful for this court in understanding how the law applies, the standards of law as they apply in the context of whether defense counsel needs expert assistance. And I would also point this court as a further demonstration of the application of the law in Richter to a case that the government cited to Crane versus State, which is a 2011 Florida Supreme Court case, which the government understands is only persuasive authority. But in that case, the defense counsel was faced with a situation where the government presented an expert regarding scratch marks. And these scratch marks were important because they were found on the defendant's arm shortly after a 7-year-old victim went missing. And instead of getting his own expert to rebut the government expert's testimony that these scratch marks were consistent with scratch marks from a 7-year-old, he conducted adequate pretrial investigation. He deposed the government's expert for 3 hours. And in doing so, he was able to develop an effective cross-examination and show that those scratch marks were consistent with many objects that the defendant encountered on a day-to-day basis at his occupation. And the Supreme Court of Florida analyzed that situation and said, basically reaffirming the principles that were established in Richter that had its origins in Strickland, saying that the defense counsel doesn't have to have an equal expert every single time the government calls an expert.
Presumably you're drawing our attention to the statement in Richter that cross-examination can adequately deal with an expert. You don't always have to have an expert for an expert. If there had been an expert in this case, let's say they had renewed their request, is there or would there have been a delta between what did come out on cross and what might have come out on cross if O'Neill had come in as an expert?
Your Honor, I don't believe that.
Is there a delta, and if so, how do you address it?
Yes, Your Honor. I don't believe that there would have been much difference. If you look at BO's report that was submitted after trial and you compare it to the testimony of TB at trial, the three main differences that you find are there are minor discrepancies in TB's medical findings that BO says she would have disagreed with. There's also a difference in terminology that were used between the two experts. And lastly, BO says that she would have requested additional literature that TV was relying on in order to form the basis of some of her findings and conclusions. Those were really the three main discrepancies, but when you look to the major consistencies that you had between the two, there really wouldn't have been any need for the defense to delay trial and to have BO come testify, because she wouldn't have shed any new light on these three points.
Do you believe that the pivot in this case is on whether the cross-examination was effective or not?
I believe that is a very key factor in this case, Your Honor.
And if we were to find that it was effective, you believe the government would prevail? And if we were to find it was ineffective, do you believe the appellant should, or whatever we're calling that side, should prevail?
I believe it's a key consideration of this court. I think
it's not a trick question. It may be a tricky question, but not a trick question. Does the government still prevail if it's not effective cross-examination for some other reason based on standards or some other thing?
Yes, Your Honor.
Or is it fair to say that either it's effective or it's not, and that's the case right there?
I think whether defense counsel's cross-examination, whether it was effective, goes to the second prong of the Polk analysis, which would be whether there was deficiency. But I don't think it would impact, even if the defense counsel's cross-examination wasn't effective, it still wouldn't affect the prejudice prong of this court's analysis, because really, even though the government spends quite a bit of time in its brief arguing that this court shouldn't consider BO's report because it's viewed from it's a post-trial retrospection where it's viewed from hindsight and we're not supposed to engage in this Monday morning quarterbacking. It's still, if you would line those two up, there's still no difference between the ultimate conclusions.
Well, what do we do? Do we ignore it or do we consider it?
Well, the government would say that this court should ignore it, and when you do so, you are then left with the situation that you're left with in every case where you just have the record to look at.
I mean, it seems to me, counsel, that there's language in Richter that suggests that, just to suggest, I mean, it says that this representation is constitutionally ineffective only if it so undermined the proper functioning of the adversarial process that the defendant was denied a fair trial, and that they don't have to, that a miscalculation or a mistake doesn't necessarily rise to that level. So asking Chief Judge Baker's question a different way, you know, even if the cross-examination wasn't all that it could have been, was the appellant denied a fair trial?
No, Your Honor. And the reason for it was because there was no prejudice in this case. And the reason there was no prejudice is...
But that doesn't answer the question that you want us to answer. You won on prejudice below. You want us to say that there was no ineffective assistance of counsel.
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, the issue, you know, the government hopefully isn't certifying on something that they won on, right? You want us to say that it wasn't performance. And so you need to tell us why that is.
And I'm saying,
I mean, assuming for the sake of argument, you know, that we say, oh my gosh, this cross-examination was not effective at all, and these other considerations should be taken out of the picture entirely, you know, why wasn't he denied a fair trial?
Because his defense counsel had an effective cross-examination. That is a key consideration.
So that is the pivot.
That is one of the key considerations. Another key consideration is that the defense counsel engaged in adequate pretrial investigation. That is another area where the defense could have faltered, but they did not here, because they, even though they were not experts in sexual assault examinations themselves, they conducted sufficient investigation before the case to become competent in this area of expertise. And in doing so, they interviewed TV on three occasions prior to trial. The last interview was for a total of 3 hours, where they said in their declarations that they explored all the bases for her findings and conclusions, and this was really the origin of their ability to develop this cross-examination. So there are several factors that go hand-in-hand to show why the defense counsel was not deficient in this case. First being that this was not a case where, like Rompelia versus Baird, the Supreme Court analyzed the case where the government served on the defense shortly before trial, a case file that was going to be harmful to them, and the government told them, we're going to seek this felony conviction as an aggravating circumstance in a capital murder case, and the defense counsel did absolutely nothing. Nothing to prepare. But here the defense counsel engaged in sufficient pretrial preparation. They developed an effective cross-examination of TB, and they executed that cross-examination.
Counsel, leaving aside any question of waiver, do you think it's a good idea to have sexual assault advocates sitting on the panel on a sexual assault case?
I don't believe it's an ideal situation, Your Honor, but I do think, like any other evaluation that we do during voir dire to see if a challenge for cause should have been made, you have to look at the record itself and the very specific facts. And I see that I'm over my time, if it's okay to conclude.
You can finish the answer or whatever you're doing.
Yeah, I'd like to hear what you have to say.
I believe that it's important to look at the record. And just because two victim advocates had been trained as victim advocates, it's also important to look at the voir dire questions to see what was elicited by counsel. And in this case, they had only received the training. They had never actually acted as victim advocates.
Would that matter? Should that matter?
It could matter, Your Honor, especially looking at some of this court's precedents in United States versus Smart, where it can matter if someone was a victim or knew someone who was a victim of a similar crime, or United States versus Terry, where there was a close relationship or somebody had provided professional assistance to someone who was a victim of a traumatic crime, or if the person, like United States versus Martinez, had demonstrated an inelastic predisposition towards a particular punishment because they served in that capacity. So I do believe that it matters, Your Honor.
Can I restate the question? Do you believe that the counsel's statements as to why they selected those two people were objectively reasonable?
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that your Strickland way of answering that question?
Yes, Your Honor.
Thank you. Do you want to? You're not going to do rebuttal. Do you want to do a summary?
Yes, Your Honor, if I may.
In 10 seconds or less?
Yes, Your Honor. The Supreme Court said it best recently in Harrington versus Richter by declaring that, quote, Strickland does not enact Newton's third law for the presentation of evidence requiring every prosecution expert an equal and opposite expert from the defense. Applying due deference to defense counsel's decisions demanded by Strickland, the record demonstrates that trial defense counsel provided effective representation in this case, and appellee's conviction sentence should be affirmed.
Thank you. You don't have to give up your rebuttal. My understanding was you were choosing to before.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you.
Chief Judge Baker, judges of this honorable court, the defense's attorneys in this case were wholly unprepared, wholly uneducated on a crucial element of this case related to the sexual assault examination. And as a result of them being unprepared, they were unable to meet the government's case, and the results of this trial are not reliable.
Well, they got the expert to admit that it could have been the result of consensual sexual activity, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
And that's what you wanted the expert to admit.
That's one of the things that the expert should have admitted. But she stated actually in a more qualified manner than that, Your Honor. She stated that it was medically possible that it was the result of a one-time insertion. But that was after stating on numerous occasions that through her experience, trauma to the anal region only occurs through forceful sodomy.
So at what point in time, in your opinion, would a constitutionally effective counsel have demanded an expert? Because it seems to me that what you're saying is that they needed to have an expert from the beginning.
Yes, Your Honor, they should have.
Okay, so is it your view that the CCA was wrong when it said that the initial trial decision to not have a sane expert was not an effective assistance of counsel?
Yes, the CCA was wrong in that respect, specifically with this case, and for a number of reasons. First of all, Judge Rohn in his dissent stated that they should have had one from the beginning.
Well, that's fine that he said in the dissent. I'm not asking about his dissent. I'm asking you to explain at what point, what the constitutional deficiency is and when.
Yes, Your Honor. And I was referring to this, I understand he's reviewed de novo, but he went on at length about how sexual assault cases are often closely litigated cases and how an expert witness can have a huge sway over military members. But this case has additional reasons why they were ineffective and why this pretrial investigation was not sufficient from the beginning. First, these attorneys admitted through their motion to compel that they didn't have any formal or informal training related to sexual assault examinations, and stated that their client would likely, that the trial would likely result in an unfair trial if they didn't have this.
And how is their strategic decision that they explained that they withdrew the request basically in order to have the same expert that the government had limit her testimony, how is that objectively unreasonable?
Your Honor, I don't believe that statement in their affidavit is supported by the record.
They're lying in their affidavit?
I'm not saying they're lying, Your Honor. I don't believe it's supported by the record. The defense counsel establishes the record for why the motion to compel was withdrawn. And the defense counsel states, and this is slightly paraphrasing, that the government has chosen not to prevent this evidence, and therefore we don't feel a need any longer to have this expert witness.
Well, it's true that the expert witness's testimony about the vaginal trauma was there in the Article 32, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And she didn't testify about it at the trial.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay, and I'm saying if that happened because of the reasons that the defense counsel said, how is that an objectively unreasonable strategic decision?
Because, Your Honor, their strategic decision is to remain uneducated on a crucial part of their case. They simply can't make strategic decisions when they haven't educated themselves on the facts. And that's what Strickland says. It's not a strategic decision, and you don't get deference that's virtually unchallengeable when you're not educated
on the facts. So is it your view that in every instance, in every case involving sexual trauma, that it's ineffective assistance of counsel to not have an expert?
No, Your Honor.
Well, it sounds to me like that's what you're saying.
No, Your Honor.
Because you can't be educated without one.
No, Your Honor. A number of attorneys are educated on sexual assault examinations. These particular attorneys were not educated when it comes to sexual assaults. Additionally, these attorneys knew that the expert witness in this case was a family friend. So more than just not being able to rely upon an opposing party's witness to educate yourself, they knew that this witness was a family friend. They also knew and were suspect of this expert witness's training. This expert witness had never been qualified as an expert before at trial. And in the clemency report, the defense attorney talks about how this expert witness lacked training. You simply can't rely on an expert witness that's biased and go forward. They were deficient from the very beginning of their pretrial investigation.
And can we tell from the record or from your briefs or from anything you may have cited in your briefs exactly what kind of training would have made a difference here?
For the attorneys?
For anybody. I mean, seems to me like the expert opinion here is based upon logic and fact. That is, in my opinion, these injuries were as a result of forcible trauma. However, I agree that under some circumstances, consensual sex could result in the same injuries. Is there any expert in the United States that would have testified under the facts of this case that this was clearly the result of consensual sex?
No
expert. And the defense expert would have testified exactly the same way at the end of the day?
No, she would not have, Your Honor.
She wouldn't have said this is possibly a result of trauma?
She would have said it was possibly the result of trauma, Your Honor.
And she would have said it's possibly a result of not of
yes,
consent. And isn't that what the government's expert said?
No, Your Honor. The government expert said that this was medically possible one-time insertion after basically having her arm twisted. The jury, the military members, can read through the line. She said,
"Well, she was just a squirrely witness."
she was a squirrely witness.
And you're saying the defense counsel lacked the capacity to get her out of the tree?
She's stating that she, in her ER experience, is examining numerous people who have engaged in consensual sex, and she's not seeing any tearing with these people. And she's saying that, in her opinion, the consensual sex is for pleasure, and as a result, you never see trauma in the anal region. But yes, when she had her arm twisted, she was forced to go back to her Article 32 testimony, and the smallest of margins say that it was medically possible. But the military members knew what she was saying. She felt that the force was present, necessary to meet the elements of sodomy in this case.
Was there any objection to her testimony?
No, Your Honor. But the defense attorneys weren't able to object because they weren't aware of the things that were presented in the post-trial report from Ms. Becky O'Neill, a more seasoned and experienced defense attorney. They didn't know that the government expert was mislabeling basic human anatomy. They didn't know that she was misinterpreting the Trulene dye. They didn't know that she was exaggerating her experiencing, citing to non-existent to non-existent literature to support her testimony. All of these things would have completely undermined her testimony, and she decided to have that damage.
Well, that also is going to your disagreement with that there was no prejudice, and I understand that. But what do you do about the strategic reasons that the trial counsel, the trial defense counsel, gave as to why they didn't ask for an expert at that time? What do you do about the fact that she did make the critical concession, however unwillingly? Their discussion about that opening the door to prior consistent, the two witnesses that were hanging out there, and what do you do about their concern about the additional testimony that could have come in? Because you would agree that even if the defense counsel had a sane expert, that the government can still bring their expert back on and rebuttal, right, to talk about the additional injuries, to the additional vaginal injuries. I mean, how do you discount the strategic reasons that the defense counsel has given for their decision not to ask for an expert at that time, because that's what you need to do?
Yes, Your Honor. First of all, I feel like I already stated that I don't feel like their decisions were strategic, so they're not given that deference. But with that said, they do offer reasons. Something for this court to consider.
But what I'm asking you is to say why they weren't strategic, why those aren't valid reasons for doing what they did. I understand that you would have tried the case differently, but that's not the Strickland standard. So explain why their decisions were not strategically, objectively reasonable.
Yes.
Which doesn't mean they were the best decisions. It means objectively reasonable.
Yes, Your Honor. If you notice, the attorneys in this case provided two affidavits. Both attorneys provided two affidavits, and there's a reason why they both provided two affidavits. Because in the first affidavit, both of them asserted that they didn't get an expert witness, that they withdrew their motion to compel in order to get to trial expeditiously. But what happened was, is when the answer was submitted in reference to that, it was noted that the government was granted a two-month delay that the defense attorneys couldn't do anything about. And so there was no expeditious movement to trial. And as a result, you see subsequent affidavits that talk about different reasons other than avoiding a delay for why they decided to forego an expert witness in this case. They do say that we wanted to avoid, inculpatory evidence. However, they don't have any evidence that the government didn't already know about those things. And again, the government had a two-month delay already in place, and the defense attorney's assertions for why they wanted to avoid a delay just doesn't stand.
Well, how do you know that? Didn't they say that they couldn't have gotten their expert within that two-month window?
They did say they couldn't have gotten an expert within a two-month window.
And how do we know that's not accurate? It is an affidavit. Are we supposed to ignore the affidavit?
No, Your Honor.
Is there something unreasonable, objectively unreasonable, if they could not get a witness within that time frame to not request that witness?
Your Honor, they don't provide any evidence. The affidavits don't provide any support. It's just they're opining. We don't think we could have gotten someone within that time frame.
Well, I mean, they're explaining their strategic decisions. I mean,
What is the pivot point in this case for you? Because you've hit on a couple of things, failure to investigate, failure to call the expert in the first instance, failure to renew the request. I asked the government whether the cross-examination was the pivot point, and they, I believe, indicated that it was. Do you have a pivot point, or What is your focal point here?
Your Honor, I do believe that the cross-examination is the pivot point for prejudice. Because if this expert witness had testified in a manner that was not as impeachable as this witness had done, had not exaggerated her experience, mislabeled it, then there wouldn't have been any prejudice, even if these military members, even if these defense attorneys had been uneducated. But the pivot point for deficiency, although the Air Force Corps reviewed de novo, Their pivot point, they say it was after the person testified, which is acceptable. But in my opinion, the pivot point was when in the pretrial investigation. Under Wiggins v. Smith, the Supreme Court, the attorneys alleged, well, we were focused somewhere else, which is why we didn't conduct an investigation in that matter. But the Supreme Court found in Wiggins v. Smith that it was simply an inattention to detail and not focusing somewhere else. And the fact is, this was more than just an inattention to detail by these attorneys. This was an egregious mistake on their part.
Well, when you say this was an egregious mistake. What is this?
To be uneducated, I'm not saying that they had to have an expert in this case, but to be uneducated and...
What didn't they know that they would have learned if they had investigated more fully?
They would have known that the expert witness was exaggerating the damage to the anus. They would have known that she didn't know how to use toluene dye. They would have known...
This is the delta between O'Neill and... Anything other than the delta between O'Neill and the government expert that said neutrally. In terms of what they should have learned through a proper investigation, in your view, what they should have learned is the difference between what O'Neill knew and the government's expert. Is that fair to say?
Yes, Your Honor.
There's not some other thing they failed to investigate that they should have known.
No. No, Your Honor.
Had they called O'Neill as a witness, wouldn't you be arguing that they were ineffective for putting a witness up who agreed with the government?
I might be, Your Honor, but that wouldn't be as an effective argument.
Okay.
And the fact is this case can be looked at in a number of different ways. I mean, the defense attorneys clearly, even if they would have had a government expert, they're not necessarily required to call her. They could have impeached Tanya Burton and put a shadow on the government's entire case. Or they could have called Mrs. O'Neill and simply had a battle of an expert, which case law contemplates as a legitimate way to wage litigation. Because the fact is the SMS testimony simply wouldn't have stood on its own. It required the bolstering of an expert witness based on the facts of the case. We know that SMF went to Airman de Taves at night at 03 in the morning, that his landlords, he was residing in a single-family home, his landlords answered the door with barking dogs that awoke in the middle of the night. She woke up Airman de Taves, she initiated sex, she took off her clothes, and after the sexual encounter, she told him that she would call him, and in fact did try to contact him three times after the situation. So without the bolstering of the expert witness, the testimony, there's more than a reasonable possibility that there would have been a different outcome in this case.
Counsel, standing alone, would your allegations regarding the victim's advocate and the attempted impeachment allow you to prevail?
No, Your Honor, and I'm not really addressing those in a large amount of detail, but those wouldn't have been raised as individual allegations. But to the extent that this court is struggling to find prejudice in this case, I do feel that those things can be considered together.
Was the issue as the advocates waived?
Your Honor, it was waived.
Okay.
Waived.
Enough said.
Yes, Your Honor.
They weren't trained by the government's expert, perchance, were they?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. Your Honor, the defense attorneys were simply missing a huge part of this case. They walked in this case, and it's not a strategic decision to remain uneducated on a fundamental part of your case. Had they been educated, or had they had an expert witness in their case, there's a reasonable probability of a different result in this case. And that concludes my remarks, unless there are any other questions.
Thank you, counsel. Government, did you want a rebuttal or not? Okay, the case is now submitted. We thank both counsel, and the court will stand in recess until 10:20. Thank you very much.
All rise. Court stands in recess until 10:20.